Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Good afternoon. Obviously, I am not Vicki St. Clair, but you are tuned into the right program. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My name is Eric Ryder. I'm the engineer and producer for the program. I'm sure you probably heard me chatting with Vicki from time to time on the show. As many of you know, Vicki's mother passed away recently, and she headed back to England to help her family with everything that that entails. But unfortunately, she was going to be hosting the show today via phone from Old Blighty, but unfortunately she was hit with a bout of laryngitis, so apparently she is not audible on the phone. So I decided to step in and help out with the show today. So it's kind of a team effort. I've got some of Vicki's notes on our fantastic guests today. That'll be helping out, and then I'll be talking to some fantastic guests. So make sure you stay tuned. Today we're going to be talking to author Nicole Young. She's got a brand new book out about food photography, and it's a very interesting world, to be sure. And we'll find all about it from Nicole. Also coming up in just a little bit is author Priscilla Warner, and Priscilla is a very successful author, but she has often suffered from panic attacks, and she finally figured out how to beat those panic attacks. She's got a new book out called Learning to Breathe, and she'll tell you more about that when we talk to her in just a few minutes. But right now, we're going to be starting with Alan Topol. Alan is the national best-selling author of seven novels of international intrigue, including Spy Dance. His novels have been translated into Chinese, Japanese, Portuguese, and Hebrew, and he's a graduate of Carnegie Institute of Technology and majored in chemistry, abandoned science, and obtained a law degree from Yale University. He's a partner in a major Washington law firm and an avid wine collector. He has traveled extensively researching dramatic locations for his novel. His new book is called The China Gambit. Alan, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today on Conversations Live.
Thanks very much for having me, Eric. A pleasure to be here.
And I do like to give out your website here just from right from the top, so people listening at any time can check in with your website and find out about your books. It's alantopol.com, and Alan is spelled A-L-L-A-N, and Topol is T-O-P-O-L. .com. And you're the author of several books, as we mentioned, and this latest one is called The China Gambit. Can you kind of set the scene for us and tell us what The China Gambit is all about?
Sure, Eric. On the one hand, it's an entertaining page-turner, and it's meant to be like my other novels. I'll just give you the three-sentence version. A young woman is a newspaper reporter on a very big story in Calgary, Canada. And something happens to her, so her dad becomes involved, a former CIA agent, and he teams up with her boss, her editor, Elizabeth, and the two of them, like unpeeling an onion a layer at a time, they start in Calgary, and then they go to Iran, and then they go to Beijing, and finally back to Washington. And in the course of finding out what happened to his daughter, he uncovers a daring plot that involves oil, it involves China and Iran. And I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but I would like to say that I wrote the book in large part as sort of a wake-up call for Americans about China's growing military might. And I'm based in Washington. You all are in Seattle, in the state of Washington.
In the other Washington.
but you're on the other side of the Pacific, across from China.
Yep.
And so China's growing military might is even a more dramatic set of events for you all than it is for us on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm. And they're a major trading partner for us as well. So, the relationship between the United States and China is very important for us in the Pacific Northwest because of the, you know, we have the several ports that bring in a lot of these Chinese goods that are available throughout the country, obviously. So that any tension between the two countries obviously affects us in a major way.
Well, and it also does because the subject of the novel involves oil, and I think I suspect your listeners knew that the minute I mentioned Calgary in Canada, because that's, of course, the center of the Canadian oil industry. And the question is, what's going to happen to that Canadian oil? Is it going to go across the Pacific to China, or is it going to move into the United States? And that's one of the issues that's dealt with in the China Gambit, which is a very, very sensitive issue politically.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've taken kind of the interesting route when I read your bio here, you're talking about how you studied science, you studied chemistry, you're a lawyer. How did becoming an author fall into that life plan?
Well, Eric, I always wanted to write, and I wanted to write novels. Mm-hmm. I did some nonfiction articles and along the way, but really writing fiction was what I always wanted to do. And so I published two novels early on, one in 1978, one in 80, The Fourth of July War and A Woman of Valor. And then I took off from novel writing for a number of years. We had several children, and I had to concentrate on being a lawyer to raise the money to educate the children. And when the last child went off to college, then I turned back to writing with a vengeance, and I had four books published in the space of 5 years. Two were national bestsellers, Spy Dance and Enemy of My Enemy. And then I then did this trilogy involving Craig Page and the woman he teams up with, Elizabeth Crowder, because we have a strong female character. And that was the first of the trilogy. The second one, The Spanish Revenge, will be coming out in September. But, you know, when I talk about writing with you like this, I realize that so much has changed in the last couple years with the advent of e-books. Because before, I had these earlier novels, and if someone would say, gee, how can I get one of your earlier novels, I would have to hem and haw and say, the answer is with difficulty. Maybe you can find it. Maybe you can order it. But, of course, e-books have changed all that because all of my prior books are now up on e-books. And for authors, it's really, really made a difference. Mm. And, you know, I also felt, Eric, I wanted to write thrillers. But I had another objective because a lot of people are writing thrillers, and it's kind of a crowded field. And I think I've carved out a niche for myself of doing books which are suspense and they're page turners, and they involve danger. I don't like to do a lot of dead bodies, but danger and suspense.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, they deal with serious international background issues. And so what I like to say is that the reader reading one of my books will not only be entertained, but will come away with having learned something. And that's the kind of niche that I've tried to get myself into. And it's been very, very satisfying, judging from reader responses.
Well, again, the new book is called The China Gambit. And, China is often in the news, as we talked about at the beginning of this interview, how important the relationship between China and America is. And your book really kind of talks about the military expansion. Now, also recently in the news, Barack Obama has been making some changes in where our military lies throughout the world, shifting some of our troops to Pacific Rim areas. I've heard talk of them opening bases in Australia, which up to this point hasn't really been a major military area for the United States. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you're absolutely right. What's happened is officials in the Pentagon and in the administration recognize the tremendous growth in China's military. Clearly, there's still below ours, but they've been growing their defense budget at a rate of 12% a year for the last decade. They've now caught up with us in submarines. They have an aircraft carrier. They have two-thirds the number of fighter jets that we have. They have about half the number of warships that we have. They have very sophisticated missiles, and I think Obama's moves into the Pacific indicate an effort to sort of respond to the Chinese growth. Now, I'm not suggesting in my book that or here that a war with China is inevitable, but the basic point is that we have a number of flashpoints, of potential flashpoints between the U.S. and China. One of them is Taiwan, which the United States has treaty obligations to, and the Chinese regard as a renegade province. Another one is Japan. There's controversy as to sea rights with Japan. And the Philippines, an area of dispute has flared up again as to rights to certain sea lanes. And those are all allies of the United States. And we have treaty obligations to them. And I think by Obama's troop moves, he's saying to China, look, we will stand up for the people that we have defensive obligations to. We will come to their aid, and we want to be in a position to militarily do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add to the fact that, which is at the core of my novel, The China Gambit, that the United States and China are both trying to, we're both vying for the same oil on the world market, which is in short supply. And again, that competition between the United States for oil, wherever it is in the world, is a potential flashpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think we have to recognize, is the risk that one or the other side could make a misjudgment about what the other is going to do. And we could end up with an outbreak of hostilities, which on the one hand seems unthinkable, but on the other hand, that's how battles begin over issues such as oil rights and territorial rights. And it's a very, very a cause for considerable concern right now.
Well, we are unfortunately running out of time, but I can't let you go without getting your thoughts on the Chen Guangcheng situation. And he was the blind Chinese rights activist who recently sought asylum at the American embassy in China, and was looking to come to the United States. And from what I understand, they negotiated a deal where he's going to be able to study in the United States, and apparently his family is being offered protection as well. I was wondering what your thoughts were on that, if you think that that situation resolved itself in a good way, and if you think we're going to see more of that sort of thing.
I think it resolved itself in a way that's face-saving for both sides.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese would like him to come to the United States because that way he's a thorn in their side and he's out of the country, and him being a dissident in the United States won't really affect their regime. So they gain a lot by getting rid of him, mm-hmm. getting him out of the country. And they may, never mind that it's called a temporary visa, the Chinese are likely to take the position that he won't be permitted back because he's a dissident. So it's face-saving for the Chinese. It gives them what they want. They get rid of a dissident. The United States can say, well, we freed Chen, and so we did some good. So for us, it's a little bit of a face-saving, too. I think one lesson that comes out of it is the original deal wasn't for him to come to the United States, for him to go to law school there and, mm-hmm. and be able to live there. That was the deal our State Department negotiated with the Chinese Foreign Service. And I think the Chinese Foreign Ministry was basically overruled by the security apparatus. So it's an unfortunate incident, and both sides probably settled in a face-saving way, but it leaves a very, very bad taste and indicates we're going to have further disputes of this type in the future.
Well, obviously, you've done a lot of research about China, and I know that just informs the book. The book, again, is The China Gambit, and well worth your time. If you want to find out more about Alan, go to his website, alantopel.com, and check out the new book, The China Gambit. That's available at all the major bookstores, the Amazons and Barnes & Nobles of the world. Is that
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely, and it's also on ebook platforms, all of the above. Correct, Eric.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us today. We really appreciate it.
Enjoyed it very, very much. Thanks again for having me.
All right, everybody, do stay tuned for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Eric Ryder here filling in. And Vicki will be back next week with a brand new show. Stay tuned. We're coming right back. We'll be talking to author Priscilla Warner about her new book called Learning to Breathe. And that's what I'm going to do during the break here. Stay tuned, everybody.
I could escape this feeling with my China girl. I feel a wreck without my little China girl. I hear her heart beating loud as thunder.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Want to hear something different from talk radio? The choice is clear. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM, and welcome back to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Obviously, I am not Vicki St. Clair. If you joined us at the top of the show, you know that she's in England this week and unfortunately suffering from a bout of laryngitis, so she has no voice. So I am being the voice of Vicki today. Filling in for her and doing my normal duties here as the engineer and producer of Conversations Live. And my name's Eric Ryder. If I didn't mention that, I think I did. And obviously, filling in at the last minute for someone like Vicki St. Clair, who does a great job every week asking our guests questions, it causes a little anxiety, I got to admit. I wouldn't say it's created a panic attack, but definitely caused a little anxiety, which leads me right into our next guest, which is Priscilla Warner. And she's going to be talking about her new book called Learning to Breathe. And Priscilla grew up in Providence, Rhode Island. She graduated from the University of Pennsylvania and spent many years in Boston and New York as an advertising art director, shooting ads for everything from English muffins to diamond earrings. Priscilla co-authored the New York Times bestselling memoir, the Faith Club, and then toured the country for 3 years, hyperventilating her way through an extended book tour. Finally, in the skies over Oklahoma, she vowed to find her inner monk and began meditating her way from panic to peace. And now Vicky has included some notes on panic disorder here. She says, according to the National Institute of Mental Health, panic disorder affects approximately 6 million American adults over the age of 18 in any given year. Welcome to the show, Priscilla Warner.
Thank you for having me.
So your book is called Learning to Breathe. And as your bio talks about, you were you're a very successful author already, and you sound like you're leading kind of a fun life, you know, a life of adventure, excitement, doing commercials and stuff like that in the book. And what did you have to panic about, I guess, is the first question.
Well, I wasn't guest hosting for somebody live on the radio.
Yeah.
But, that's the thing. A lot of people have written me since my book came out. This is the paperback version.
Mm-hmm.
It's just coming out. And they sound like me. You know, they've had successful careers. They've managed to carve out, you know, a wonderful life for themselves. But it's kind of a quiet secret that underneath it all, they're kind of a quivering massive insecurity would be a nice way to put it. So, you know, that's what anti-anxiety medication is there for. It really helped me to function for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was on that last book tour and sort of popping Klonopin to fly and then to speak publicly, it makes you a little tired.
Yeah.
And mostly, always in the back of my mind, I was wondering if there was another way. And I've been reading about these Tibetan monks who meditate so effectively that neuroscientists study their brains.
Mm.
And they can see exactly what's taking place when they're in a meditative state. So I was taking off from Tulsa, Oklahoma on a leg of a book tour. I opened up a magazine. There were the monks again. I took it as a sign, and I said, I want the brain of a monk.
Mm. Okay. Now, your first panic attack happened when you were 15, is that right?
Yes.
And apparently it was pretty severe. Tell us about that panic attack. What was going on physically, mentally, and emotionally with that?
Well, I was 15 years old. I was working as a waitress. I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and I went to an all-girls school, and my friends and I had this idea that if we waitressed at Brown University, that would be, you know, a calming experience. Now, we thought it would be exciting to meet boys, and apparently it was, I don't know that that's what caused my panic attack, because they seemed to come out of the blue, but I was dishing out peas to hordes of young men who I was hoping would notice me, and then all of a sudden I hoped they weren't noticing me because I just felt like I was dying. I mean, I started to hyperventilate, which I'd never had happen before. You know, your heart starts pounding, your lungs start sort of racing and convulsing, and you're trying to force air into your body.
Mm-hmm.
You think you can't breathe, but you're really breathing too much. But back then, I'm a little bit, how shall I say? Well, I'm middle-aged, and back then there was no word for panic attack, and I say, you know, there was no, nobody was spilling their guts on national television about all their anxieties
mm-hmm.
and personal experiences, so I really just thought I was a complete freak, and I managed to get home, and a doctor came, paid a house call, and that's how long ago it was, and he said, he took my vital signs, he said, you're just a little bit nervous. And he prescribed an anti-anxiety medication, which was, you know, kind of radical back then for a teenager. So mm-hmm. I took anxiety medication on and off over the years, and it really did help in so many ways. I mean, I'm not anti-anxiety medication,
mm-hmm.
but there's so many other things that you can do yourself that are really healing and powerful.
But it was quite a journey, apparently, though, for you to get to the point where you weren't taking the anxiety medication, and you were, changing your mind to be more like a monk, I guess, with the meditation. But did you ever go through a phase where you were self-medicating or trying other things that didn't work, or maybe worked to a certain extent, but didn't fulfill you in the way that you would hope?
Yes. Well, when I was a teenager, I carried a flask of vodka around with me, actually for a very long time,
mm-hmm.
because it wasn't to get drunk, but it was, I discovered that if I swallowed some vodka,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it was odorless, is what I was told back then, that it would what it did was it sort of bathed my lungs in this warm glow, and it felt mm-hmm. like I was slowing myself down. I knew I wasn't, but the alcohol was. And then a lot of the treatments and techniques that I learned of sort of self-regulation, things like somatic experiencing and EMDR in the process of writing this book, they do the same thing without alcohol, which is you learn how to slow your body down and how to self-regulate and how to discharge all of those sensations that used to be triggers for panic. You know, if your heart starts to pound, that's a good thing. The fight or flight response is there for a reason. As one of the Buddhist teachers I studied with said, you know, if we didn't have one, you know, we couldn't just sun ourselves on rocks all these years. You know, our ancestors, you know, life is hard and lots of curveballs get thrown your way. And there's a reason to get worked up, but there are many ways to slow yourself down.
Hmm. Now, obviously, being this happened when you were a teenager, right? You were carrying around the flask of vodka.
Oh, yeah. And then through my 20s and 30s, you know, I was in advertising. So
now,
advertising isn't exactly the calmest profession
right.
I could have chosen.
working in the media, I definitely understand that. Didn't it cause additional anxiety, though, being, you know, underage and carrying a flask of vodka, thinking like, oh, you know, this could get me in trouble? Did that?
Yes. But it turns out, you know, when I had this disorder for such a long time that all kinds of things were, like, working themselves through my system, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't really aware of it. I don't know, you'd be amazed what you can adapt to in life, and having all of these panic attacks, now I look back and I think, wow, you know, what, your poor body. But at the time, it was just who I was. And even in the process of this experience, when I really did heal from the panic disorder, there was a period where I really kind of missed it, you know, and it was kind of my constant companion. It was my sort of my own little unique, I don't know, my way of being Priscilla, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought, am I going to just be a serious monk, for God's sake, when I finally reached my goal? Like, what about my sense of humor, you know, my deprecating, slightly neurotic? I found it to be slightly charming. I can't say that anybody else did. But really, you know, we define ourselves by our stories over the years, and that just became my story.
And the book is, from what I understand, actually very humorous. That's Vicky puts that in her notes that she passed on to me. So that is good. So this
I'm
sounds
told,
like
yes.
It, already I could tell from talking to you that this is not going to be a real dry read. But you went through, you tried other things like spiritual chanting, meditative painting, apparently Kabbalistic teachings, and Ayurvedic oil treatments. Can you talk a little bit mm-hmm. about some of these things
sure.
and how they worked for you or didn't work for you?
Sure. Well, my first book was called The Faith Club, and mm-hmm. it was an interfaith dialogue between me, I'm Jewish, a Muslim woman, and a Christian woman, all New Yorkers after 9/11. And so I explored my spiritual roots and my religious roots during that process, and I'd always heard about mystics, and I didn't really know what a mystic was, so I was really eager to meet some monks and mystics, and I met a young Tibetan monk who'd had panic attacks as a child, and then I met this rabbi who I did this Jewish ritual bath, and I ended up having these fantastic conversations about how to find your soul and how to heal your soul with this Kabbalistic rabbi. I've always been an artist. I make jewelry, and I heard about something called tanka painting, which is when you paint the face of the Buddha, and it's very prescribed. If you think about a Buddha statue, it's perfectly aligned. Every feature is symmetrical. So you have to draw this very symmetrical grid, and then very carefully, with every little, you know, little feathery move of your pencil, everything just slows down, and you're really in the moment. Anytime that you do something to the exclusion of everything else, it's what one of my teachers told me, you're in effect meditating. So, and then I tried chanting. A friend of mine said, nothing cheers me up more than chanting kirtan with Krishna Das, who's a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And I had really no idea what kirtan was. I drove out to New Jersey, and I found myself, you know, swaying and grooving to the music, but that really transports you. And Ayurvedic treatments came at the end, and they were worth waiting for. Somebody takes warm, scented oil, wonderful woman Dawn, and she drizzles it onto your third eye. For mm-hmm. some people, that sounds awful, but it's sublime.
It does sound nice. I'm not sure where my third eye is, but you know, just the warm oil bath sounds great.
In between your two eyes, just above your brow,
mm-hmm.
you know, where sometimes I don't know, it's your sweet spot, and so that was very, very cool. But you know, then I had to do some really difficult stuff: the therapies, somatic experiencing, and EMDR.
Mm-hmm.
You process disturbing memories and situations. And it was only when the foundation of the book was my meditation practice. So I learned how to meditate. I meditate for 20 minutes a day.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about meditation. I've been doing it for 3 years. You're less reactive to things, people, situations, events, thoughts. You learn how to let go a little bit more. But once you're able to sit still, you see things in a very different way. You're able to put together memories and experiences that, frankly, I don't know I could have looked at them before in quite the same way with such depth. I almost died when I was 16 months old. And my parents had always told me the story about the night you almost died. I had an acute infection in my windpipe, a 106-degree fever and convulsions, and they were terrified. They were 25-year-old parents. And
mm-hmm.
They took me to the doctor, and then I was admitted to the hospital, and then they left me, and they told me for years you almost died, and a resident happened to come into your room, find you not breathing, and performed an emergency tracheotomy. So that, you know, hence learning to breathe.
Right. So tell me about your, ultimately you found out that that meditating is what helped you to move past this hump of anxiety and panic attacks coming on. I mean, obviously the other things that you talked about, it sounded interesting and nice, like the Ayurvedic oil treatment, but that doesn't sound terribly practical when you're in an airport or on a plane or something. So
to pull out a little vial of scented oil.
Yeah, exactly, and just pour that on your head.
Well, you know, I still tell people email me, I'm like, what should I do if I'm on a plane? And I say, you know, take some anti-anxiety medication if that's what works for you. I'm not anti-medication. But what happened was in the course of this experience, I became, now when I take it, it kind of puts me to sleep, really. It's just my whole brain and my central nervous system operate mm-hmm. differently. But really the heart of it was EMDR therapy, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is very helpful for trauma and people with PTSD. And when you go through that therapy, it really alters your brain. I had my brain scanned by a neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania, and he said to me, it was an 8-week process, and he said, don't do any EMDR while you're doing this because that does affect brain change.
Mm-hmm.
So really, the most powerful things that I did were learn how to meditate, learn how to sit still, learn how to self-regulate, and then the rest is you have to learn how to be happy.
Yeah.
Which is sometimes hard, you know. It's happiness is, you know, cultivating. The heart of the Buddhist studying that I did is to achieve compassion for others. And you really can't have compassion for others until you have compassion for yourself. I learned that it isn't selfish to seek happiness. I always thought that if I was happy, I came from a family with a lot of mental illness. My father, his twin brother, my cousin, who I named after, is a homeless schizophrenic woman. I always thought that something was waiting to happen to me. And in this process, I learned to accept who I am and the way that I react to things. And that it's okay to seek happiness. The Dalai Lama, you know, that's what he talks about all the time, is that his religion is kindness, and you have to be kind to yourself.
Mm-hmm. Now, at this point, do you consider yourself to be Buddhist?
No, but I really take comfort in so many of the Buddhist teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really label myself anymore. I've met so many people in the process of writing the first book. I met Christians, Muslims, Jews, Sikhs, people of Baha'i faith, you know, atheists all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody is on a path. And there's this wonderful quote that I read somewhere, the longer I'm on a path, the less of a path there is, which is that, you know, you just move forward one moment at a time. And
right.
For the time being, yes, I find a lot of comfort in the Buddhist teaching.
So the, you know, you think that the meditation would work for anybody regardless of what their beliefs are, right?
Absolutely. I mean, all religious practices have some form of meditation,
mm-hmm.
you know, in them. I mean, it's a, you know, ancient practice, and it's really just grounding yourself and finding a safe haven and a place for yourself to be at ease.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I say to people, they say, well, you know, I was just talking to mothers this morning, and how can a busy mother learn how to meditate? You don't have to, you know, sit down for 45 minutes every day in a rigid posture. The Dalai Lama says to start off 5 minutes a day. That if you say you're going to meditate for 45 minutes, you set yourself up for disappointment. And you just start off slowly. I learned from this first monk, it was a very open-minded approach to meditation. So in the short retreat that I went to, he taught us how to meditate with our eyes open, eyes closed, sitting down, walking. Walking meditation is just wonderful. And, you know, I learned that pacing, you know, when you see people pacing or when you pace yourself, if you slow it way, 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 way down, mm-hmm. it's really just a form of meditation. We kind of, our body knows how to meditate, but I think children start off knowing how to meditate, but then our brains get full of all this other stuff. It's really not pushing the other stuff out of your mind. It's just noting it and letting go of it, noting it, letting go of it, and then just living in the moment.
Well, we've only got a little bit of time left here, Priscilla, but you end the book with seven pieces of advice. So I wanted to talk about these and why they're important kind of quickly, unfortunately. But
sure.
You say start off slowly, which you just mentioned.
Right.
Find a way in. What do you mean by that? That's number two.
Well, you know, for me, I started with these guided imagery CDs by Belruth Napersteck. It's fantastic. She's working with the Pentagon to get soldiers on the battlefield to download these. She guides you to the place that you can eventually learn how to get to by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is nature. I started taking pictures and videos. And if you are connected to something that's outside of yourself in a very thorough, complete way, it's a form of meditation. It's just anything that gets you into the space that you can eventually get to just by sitting. So it's, I said, cue the music. I had certain meditative music I listened to. Finding a teacher is really important. I recommend this dharmaseed.org, which is a website where you can download free teachings by Buddhist teachers. And every teacher is different, and every teacher has these guided meditations and dharma talks, which are Buddhist teachings talks. You can find them all online for free. And let's see, what else? I said slow down and be quiet,
mm-hmm.
just whenever you can find a moment. Like when you're done with this broadcast, perhaps, you can turn everything off, all the machinery off, and just sit and just breathe for a couple of minutes. And the last thing is try to be kind to yourself first and then to others.
I think that's good advice for everybody, regardless of whether they're suffering from anxiety or panic attacks. Priscilla, you've been a fantastic guest, and hopefully we'll be able to have you back in the future. I really enjoyed talking to you, and hopefully you'll get a chance to talk with Vicky at some point in the future. But
well, it was a pleasure talking to you in the meantime.
Thank you so much, Priscilla. And the book is Learning to Breathe. Do you want to mention your website here real
sure.
quick as we go?
It's Priscilla Warner Books.
PriscillaWarnerBooks.com. Thanks again. Have a wonderful day. Everybody stay tuned. We're coming back. We're going to be talking to author Nicole Young. And that's coming up right after these words here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. Stay tuned for more Conversations Live.
Love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicky at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. 4772.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. B. BFN.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Take one part sustained confidence, mix in the four disciplines of execution, and top it off with outside-the-box creativity, and you have a recipe for success. Vicky's guests next week are all experts in motivations associated with each of those ingredients. Chris McChesney, author of The Four Disciplines of Execution, believes that these disciplines represent a major breakthrough in how to move teams, organizations, and individuals forward and profoundly change the way you approach your goals. Psychotherapist Heather M. Hunter says if you know how the grind of a job hunt can affect you, you can prepare yourself mentally, which in the end can get you hired. And executive director of Stanford Technology Venture Program and international bestseller Tina Seeling says creativity is an asset that can be learned. Put them all together and you can't lose. Join Vicky St. Clair for Conversations Live every Monday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
Tell your friends, the place to be is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back to Conversations Live here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. Eric Ryder filling in for Vicky St. Clair. If you're joining us late, I do want to mention that Vicky will be back next week with us for another edition of the show. She is unfortunately suffering with laryngitis this week and has no voice. So I am being the voice of Vicky and having a great time talking to some wonderful guests. Before the break, we talked to Priscilla Warner about her book called Learning to Breathe, which was all about how meditation has helped her get over her anxiety and panic attacks. And now we're going to be talking to author Nicole Young, who has a new book called Food Photography, From Snapshots to Great Shots. And this actually sounds like something that could be kind of meditative. So it all ties in here on the show. Now, Nicole S. Young is a food and lifestyle photographer living in Seattle. She's a help desk specialist with the National Association of Photoshop Professionals, and she is the author of Food Photography, From Snapshots to Great Shots. Nicole, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Eric.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day here in the Puget Sound, so probably a great chance for people to get out and enjoy some photography. But the photography that you specialize in, at least for the book, is food photography. So I guess it doesn't matter really what the weather is for that, but you've got to appreciate other aspects of photography. I would imagine you didn't spend your whole life doing food photography, did you?
No, actually, food photography is it feels like a new thing to me. It's, mm-hmm. I've been doing it for maybe 2 or 3 years, and but I kind of specialize in food photography and also stock photography, mm-hmm. but I'm a photographer, so I'll photograph anything going out. I photographed the super moon the other night over Seattle, standing up in Gasworks Park. I love doing nature, landscape, anything that gets me outside with my camera. I really, I enjoy, but food photography is kind of, I guess, my specialty.
All right. Very cool. And so your photos have appeared in several publications, I assume, right?
Yeah, well, the way my business works, I'm actually kind of, it's kind of a unique business model because I do stock photography, and that's the majority of my income. I photograph whatever I want, and for me, recently, it's been food, mm-hmm. and I put them on a portfolio online, And then people, designers, whoever, you know, once needs to find photos to use for projects, they can search through an entire catalog of images. They find my images, and they license them. And I don't always know where they end up. But I've, you know, a month ago, I think I was in Portland walking through the mall, and I saw one of my photos used on a little stand in the middle of the walkway. And so I don't always know where they're going to end up, but I've found quite a few of them. So I do get to see them, a few billboards out there. It's kind of fun, actually. Kind of makes it exciting.
Yeah, it's almost, I was going to say it's almost like seeing your children out there, but, you know, I would hope that one would have a more direct connection with what their children are doing than that. So what got you interested in doing food photography? As you say, you have been a photographer in every aspect. When did you say you got started as a teenager?
Fell in love with photography when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. I needed an art credit to graduate, basically. And I decided photography, that looks like fun. Didn't really know anything about it or have any interest in it other than just that it looked like something that would be fun. And I've always been very creative, artsy, you know, working with my hands and drawing and painting. And then when I took a photography class, it was like, wow, this is it. This is the medium that I need to use to basically express myself.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the start of everything. I graduated high school. I took a year and I worked at a photo lab. And then I joined the Navy. And photography was just still a hobby. I wasn't a photographer while I was in the military. It was still just, you know, a side thing that I did for fun. And while I was in the Navy in 2006, I discovered the stock website, iStock Photo, which is, I just wanted a way to kind of get out there and actually create more photos, and with no intentions of making it what it is right now. And it, you know, I learned more about photography. I soaked up a bunch of information. I took a lot of pictures and built my portfolio up, and eventually I was able to get out of the military and make it my full-time job. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, the story of how I got to where I am right now.
Okay. All right. Very cool. So what made you want to write a book about food photography? I mean, it sounds like something that's done very well for you, and it does sound interesting, but to me, I wouldn't have necessarily thought that is this a how-to guide, or is it more a memoir, I guess?
No, it's definitely a how-to guide.
Mm-hmm.
The way, I guess, I kind of skipped over the part of how I got into food photography, I'm like a lot of home cooks. You know, people who love food, who love to cook, that's why I do food photography, because I love food. And I kind of merged two of my passions together, and I was like, well, I could start photographing food. I'm not a chef, but I enjoy the challenge of trying to make what I'm creating, you know, really look beautiful in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. And so I taught myself how to light it, how to style the food, which there's a lot involved with actually styling food. And so that's kind of how I got into food photography. And the book is a how-to book for anyone. You could pick up the book, not know anything about photography at all, and you could, I teach how to use a camera and settings and basic photography things, and then it really dives into the meat and potatoes of of actually styling and lighting and even editing the food photos in Photoshop and Lightroom or whatever your software of choice is at the end. So it's for anyone, really. But I kind of, when I wrote the book, I had foodies and food bloggers in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because I follow a lot of those. I follow a lot of blogs that people want to take pictures of their food. They're more of a cook and passionate about food than they are a photographer, but they still really want their food photos to look good.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my main person that I wrote the book for. Of course, like I said, anyone, photographers can get so much out of it. So mm-hmm. That's who the book's for, and that's why I wrote it.
You know, it's funny. I've kind of seen food photography take off on an amateur level over the last, 5 years or so. And tell me if they have noticed this as well, because of Facebook. Because at least with my friends, a lot of them like to show off the things that they cook and prepare at home, so they take a picture, and I see like all these mouthwatering pictures on Facebook all the time of you know, recipes that people have put together or whatever their favorite food to prepare, or they're at a restaurant, and so you know, this book might actually be really good for a lot of these people that just want to show off, you know, the meal that they're eating. But was your goal to kind of help people that are just getting started as a career in photography to have another way that they could go with their photos?
Well, this it could go either way. Mm-hmm. It could be for amateurs or just people who want to do it for fun. They have a food blog on the side and they just want to, you know, they have a passion for photography or they have a passion for food. And usually when we're excited about something, it doesn't matter what our job is. We still will put 100% of our energy into doing whatever it is we love. You know, most people have hobbies. And so for a lot of people, cooking or photography, those are part of their hobbies. Mm-hmm. And but with that said, you know, anyone could take the information in the book and apply it towards a professional or a commercial type of job. I mean, there's, you know, different things go into different types of setups. But I talk a lot about natural light photography, but I also talk about using, you know, studio lights and things like that. So you can use it for both sides of the field. I have my job, the way I actually use and make money off of my food photography is kind of a mix of both, because I don't do a lot of getting hired to do food, you know, like sell like a restaurant or something, you know, hires me to do food. I don't really do very much of that, mostly because I'm so busy doing everything else.
Right.
But I do kind of like what most food bloggers do. I cook whatever food I want, I photograph it, and then I put it in my stock portfolio, and, you know, in the hopes that people find it and license it and use it in their projects. So I do a lot of spec work with my photos, but it could go either way. You know, people could be, you know, hired by a restaurant and use every technique that they learned in the book and apply it to whatever job that they're working on.
All right, very cool. Well, let me ask you, do you shoot exclusively digital or do you do film? And what are your thoughts on the film versus digital divide? Do you think it's important, or do you think we've come so far with digital that it just doesn't matter anymore?
Well, you know, I started in, late 90s when I was mid to late 90s when I was in high school. So digital was really kind of, you know, not really in the scene yet. It was mm-hmm. very expensive. And so, of course, in high school, I learned how to use film and black and white and processing the images in the darkroom and using, you know, enlargers and chemicals. And I worked at a film lab, so I was able to learn the color process of how to process those images. But with that said, I absolutely love digital. I use digital way more than I use film just because of the convenience factor. And, I mean, if I had a darkroom, if I had a basement with a darkroom, I'd probably be photographing in black and white and just, you know, that'd be my hobby. It's my photography hobby within a hobby kind of a thing. But I will say that because of digital photography, I'm able to do what I do. It's not that I wouldn't have ever been able to do it with film. It's just the platform that I'm able to make my money off of is all digital, and it's all on the internet, and that would be difficult to do with film. So I'm very grateful for digital photography, but I'm also extremely grateful for the background that I have with film, because I learned so much from that. A lot of, you know, the foundations of photography mm-hmm. and, you know, why we do certain things the way we do in digital, because that's how we did them in film and how all of that works. I'm very technical. I'm very much a geek when it comes to really anything. But, you know, photography in general, you have to balance that, kind of the artist versus the geek, and find a nice balance in there, because it's, there's so much technical and math and things involved with photography. And I love film. And I have a couple of friends who pretty much only shoot film, and they just do digital every once in a while because they have to, because that's how they are able to share their things, or however, you know, right, whatever their method is. But I love both. You know, I have a Polaroid camera. I have some old film cameras, and every once in a while I'll take them out and I'll use them. But digital is, you know, the majority of what I do now.
And what do you think about, like, some of the apps like Instagram and stuff like that? Do you think that's taking the fun out of photography, or is it making it more fun, more accessible for your average person?
I think it's making it more accessible. I love Instagram. I'm all over Instagram, and I'm on social media, you know, Google+, Twitter, Facebook. And I think, if anything, you know, it allows people who maybe wouldn't have had that opportunity to be a photographer to now be a photographer. You get some people who, I guess, you know, I kind of call them the dinosaurs, who are maybe a little older, and they're just very, like, they don't want change, and they don't want the digital photographers, you know, they don't want the people who don't know anything about photography to take up a camera and say they're a photographer. I'm kind of the opposite where, you know, I think that if you could be a photographer, try to be a photographer. You know, it's a great way to, I'm very sentimental when it comes to photography because, you know, we're creating memories, we're capturing memories, we can share them with everyone. And there's so much inspiration on the web these days, every type of photography out there. You know, when you're watching, you know, looking at Facebook or Google Plus or whatever your place that you want to look at photos, you learn so much from just looking at other people's images, and you make connections and you grow with the community. So so I think that those types of things are great, you know, the Instagrams and whatever your app is.
Right. Well, unfortunately, Nicole, we are out of time, but I want to mention your website. It's NicoleSYblog.com. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, great. And people can find the book there. Is it available at all the major booksellers, or should they go to the blog to get more information on the book?
It's available everywhere. You know, it's in stores on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, at peachpit.com, and I have a link to it on my blog as well.
Fantastic. Check out her blog. It's NicoleSYblog.com. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, Eric.
Vicki St. Clair will be back next week with another edition of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-